this is my weekly podcast, Adventures with Postpartum Depression, a show dedicated to sharing stories and spreading awareness about maternal mood disorders. For show notes and more information, please go to my website, ppdadventures.com. There's also a Facebook page, facebook.com/ppdadventures. And now, on to the show. Hello, adventurers! Welcome to episode 53, and this week you will not be hearing from me, you will be hearing from Sam Kimura, who is sharing, and God, I really hope I just pronounced your last name right, Sam. I am so bad with pronunciation of names. But, you know, it's funny how you have these people that you meet through Instagram and Facebook, and I've known Sam now through social media for like about a year, and now I'm realizing that's the first time I've said her last name out loud. So yay for me and butchering of pronunciations. But, you know, I give myself like a 30% chance of getting it right. I'm recording this on Saturday evening, and the kids are on the other side of the house, supposedly eating dinner and watching some creepy YouTube videos. We have gone down a black hole of these like mass-produced, like, first, it started with these Play-Doh YouTube videos where they take like the balls of Play-Doh and roll them out and make shapes and talk a little bit about colors. And Julian's hypnotized, which it's like, okay, you're two. But Pippa is like transfixed. And sometimes it really like lulls me into this very sedated zone. So we've only wasted a few hours of our lives watching Play-Doh. But then there are these horrifying, like, bad LSD trip videos with like horses being dunked in vats of color and then like twerking gorillas and dinosaurs roaring at the twerking gorillas and gorillas selling glasses, and it is creepy shit, folks. So that's what they're doing right now if you hear shrieks or weird YouTube sounds in the background. But I'm on the other side of the house, so hopefully you won't hear me. And anyway, you're really not hearing from me this week. You're hearing from Sam. Sam has had some heartbreakingly difficult but inspiring postpartum adventures. She had the first birth. Let's start again. Okay. For those of you new to the show, I stumble over my tongue all the time. We are not network TV here. I am not a news anchor, just a mom trying to get stories out there so that everyone understands that they're not crazy, they're not weird, they're not really particularly unique. A lot of us have struggled with these postpartum depression, anxiety, OCD, various issues. Sam's experiences, she has two children who are about the ages of my children, so easy for me to remember. Her daughter, she had a traumatizing birth. It was, you know, Sam went in thinking, sort of had visions of a very beautiful, non-medicated birth, which turned into an emergency C-section and so many drugs that she can't remember the first days of her daughter's life. And then didn't have any particularly like anxious or depressing episodes after that. But when she had the birth of her son, which was about a month before Julian, so a little over 2 years ago, that's when her anxiety and depression kicked in. So we start with the traumatic birth experience, and then we go through the second child and the depression and anxiety, which really starts as anxiety first, which then turns, sort of activates the depression. But Sam has a wonderful recovery. She was hospitalized just like I was, and she got all the people in place, the support she needed to recover, and she's a nurse and was invited to join a network of, or like a team of nurses who are called, they call themselves the Mama Coaches, and Sam's a Mama Coach now. So she's taken this just horrific experience she had and has really, you know, the whole turning lemons into lemonade, or, you know, adding some vodka to make a delicious drink. I don't know, whichever way you want to think of it. She's really just, to me, so inspiring. The work she's doing now with new mamas and coming from such a place of empathy and work that is good for her soul but is helping other moms. And I could go on and keep embarrassing Sam, but instead, I'm going to turn it over to Sam. Hi, Sam. Thanks for being on the show today.
Thank you so much for having me.
So I know you very well because we've communicated a lot over the past year, so I never exactly remember where the best place to start a story is. So I'll just let you jump in.
Okay, well, I suppose my story kind of begins with my daughter. And I'm just learning so much about how postpartum depression can start, like, you know, well before you even realize that it's starting. So with my daughter, when she was born in 2013, she's 4 and a half now. When she was born in 2013, I had my heart set on a vaginal delivery. I didn't want any meds. I didn't want any interventions. I just basically wanted to walk into the hospital and have her. And so everybody knows that birth plans don't go as planned. And so I was in labor with her for well over 24 hours. And I think like I did 22 of it before I got any pain medication. So I was exhausted. And then around that 24-hour mark, sorry, it's a little bit foggy, but around that 24-hour mark, I looked down and there was blood everywhere, like blood on the bed, blood all over the floor. I looked at my husband and he was the color of the wall, and I had an abrupted placenta. So that is a very large, you know, medical emergency in the world of labor and delivery. And so I was rushed to a C-section faster than I could blink. I remember like my husband could like barely get scrubs on to get in there to see the birth of her. And I was given a lot of drugs to make sure that I didn't remember anything. Or at least like, you know, because I wasn't frozen and everything else. So they gave me a lot of drugs, and I don't remember the first couple of days of her life. And so I am learning so much now about birth trauma, mm-hmm. and how birth trauma is a completely separate part of postpartum depression. Mm-hmm. So you actually can have post-traumatic stress disorder from birth trauma. I've been in contact a lot with a birth trauma specialist actually in London, England, because I'm so interested about this and I just want to learn so much about it. But the research is very new and people are just starting to understand this. So what I didn't know was that really my journey to postpartum depression started with my first baby and how I was traumatized from that birth, but I wasn't allowed to feel any of that trauma because I was safe and she was safe. And really, we were just like, at the end of the day, I was so thankful that I had a baby that was healthy. And I didn't let myself process any of those feelings that it was traumatic and scary. And I didn't control any part of that, which is a huge, huge piece to postpartum depression, is lack of control. And so I didn't really think very much about it. I just was thankful. Like, I was just so thankful that we were okay. And then as I started, like, as she got older and I realized, like, hey, my labor wasn't quite the same as, like, all of my friends' labors and how hard it was, then I started realizing how much I just so desperately wanted that sort of beautiful labor that you have, that everybody else seemed to have. And so when I got pregnant with my second little guy, I think like the day I peed on the stick, I was like, okay, no C-section. I am not doing that again. That was such a horrible experience. And I never want to do that again. So I think like I probably started going downhill from like day one because I set these expectations so incredibly high for myself that I couldn't think of anything other than having this beautiful birth with my son. So I for sure had prenatal depression and anxiety, which again, I had no idea is even a thing. And I wasn't screened for it. I feel like the screening process for prenatal anxiety is atrocious because there's no, like, it's really hard to tell the difference between a mom who's anxious because she's worried about preterm labor, or she's like the normal mom worries, and the moms that are unreasonably anxious, or that they're moms just don't feel comfortable telling anybody really that they're just not themselves during their pregnancy. Everybody wants to believe that their pregnancy is just such a happy, beautiful thing. So I didn't really say anything, and I didn't really notice that I was not doing well. Other people did, but I didn't. I just thought I was tired. I was at risk for preterm labor with him, and so I went off work really, really early. And I thought, this is just how, I'm just not a person that loves pregnancy. And I think around like 24, 25 weeks, my manager at work called me into her office and said, you know, I'm worried about you. I don't think that you're doing well. And she's like, other people at work have noticed how you're not yourself, and we're worried about you. And of course, because I was clouded and, you know, didn't really know what was happening, I got very offended by it. And I felt like it was a personal attack on me for her saying that, like, I was not doing my job right, or I was so worried. Like, I'm a nurse, and I was so worried that patients were complaining about me. And, like, of course, like, then your mind just goes and goes and goes. So I took it very personally, and I didn't really realize, like, had I known about prenatal depression and how prevalent it is, that it's as common as postpartum depression, I maybe could have taken that as, like, a sign that I needed early intervention. But mm-hmm. at the time, there was no such thing as intervention for me. So I didn't really think about it. I just got really offended and then got really sad that my coworkers were talking about me and everything else. And, you know, like, my manager has never told me who are the people that complained, or not complained, that's a bad word. Who are the people that came to her and said that they were worried about me, but I would love to know, because I would thank them now. Like, I think that for somebody to notice that about a person and feel comfortable enough to go and ask somebody to get them help is a huge, amazing thing that somebody could do for somebody else. So I wish that I knew who did it, and I probably will never know. But if that person is listening, I'm really thankful for them, even though at the time I wouldn't have said so. So that happened, and then I went off on bed rest, and it was a disaster. Fast forward to my labor, I was very, very set on not having a C-section. As I progressed through my pregnancy, I just got worse and worse and worse. I was very, very, very set. And, you know, a week before I delivered him, my best friend said, you know, what are you going to do if you have a C-section? And I said, that's not an option. I'm not doing it. And she said, well, let's make a plan in case you do, because, like, you're a nurse, you realize that, like, plans don't always go the way you want. And so I kind of ignored her and was like, no, not doing that. And then I had him, and it was a perfect delivery. It was a perfect labor. Like, it was like you couldn't have got a more beautiful birth. In my opinion, like, it was like exactly what I'd always dreamed about, and it was great. And he came out, and I had him on my chest, and I loved that feeling of him on my chest, but there wasn't the relief that I thought there would be after I had him. Like, I thought as soon as I could get through that labor and delivery that all of the things I'm stressing about would go away, mm-hmm. and they just didn't. It just still was there. So, you know, we got home, and the way that I handle, anxiety is to be busy. So I didn't give myself a chance to rest, which I think, like, no mom should get off the couch for like 2 weeks after they have a baby. Honestly, like, I don't understand, like, in our culture, in, North American culture, or, in North American culture, I find that, like, we just have so much pressure on moms to just get back to it. You can do this. You can cook. You can clean. You can watch your two-year-old the day after you have a baby, and it's no big deal. Whereas, like, other cultures in the world, there's moms that don't do anything but feed and sleep that, like, and watch their baby, their newborn baby, for, like, a month and a half or something like that. Like, there's, I just think it, like, our society is so hard on new moms. And I was one of those people that just, I needed to be perfect. I needed to be this perfect mom for everybody. I needed people to admire how great I was doing. And so I sort of just stepped right. I thought we could just step right back into our lives and start going out, doing things, you know, on like day two. And so I didn't really give myself a chance to rest and decompress about how labor was or how I was feeling about, you know, my first labor. Like I wasn't even dealing with my first labor, and I just had another baby. And so that's sort of where I started. That was the beginning of my journey, I would say. So then after that, I knew that I wasn't coping well, but I didn't really see the signs and symptoms of postpartum depression. So I knew that it was hard. I knew that I was tired. I knew that I had a very short fuse, very, very short fuse with my daughter. Did I think I had a problem? No. I thought, this is what it's like to be a mom of two. Mm. And quite frankly, it sucked. Like, I was like, this, like, who has two kids? Like, why would you do this? This stinks, right? And so I just really, I didn't ever give myself a break. I was never kind to myself. I never did self-care. Like, the thought of having 10 minutes to myself was just so overwhelming because there were so many other things I could be doing. And then I started having irrational thoughts, which I didn't realize were irrational thoughts. So about 2 or 3 weeks postpartum, I started thinking, like, I started noticing that I wasn't coping well, but I also started realizing that nobody in my life could know about this. And so I started hiding all of the ways that I couldn't cope. So my husband would go to work in the morning and I would say goodbye and I would smile, and then he would leave and I would cry just every day. I would just cry for a solid half an hour after he went to work. Just because I felt so inadequate, and I felt like I was like my kids weren't getting everything that they deserved because I couldn't cope with both of them. And so, then I started hiding how awful I felt. So I remember still doing everything that I normally would do. I still went out every day. We still went and saw friends. I tried to do as many activities as possible because that was how I coped, was let's fill up our day with activities so that I don't have to be home in my prison, right. Which is what used to consider my house as my prison, so that I could sort of hide the fact that I was suffering.
I'm so glad you're saying that, because for me, I stayed home and was a hermit, and when I had my second, Julian, I had to force myself to leave the house so that I wouldn't turn into that hermit. And it's good to remember that just because a mom is getting out of the house, that doesn't mean she's okay. Like, that might be, like, you actually needed to slow down and spend time at home. Because this is just, oh, God, postpartum depression, it's just such a tricky beast, how it, like, you cannot lock it into one experience, one set of symptoms, one set of, like, even self-care. Because I would tell so many moms, like, oh, that's great, you got out of the house today. And I'm so glad you're telling me this, because now I'm going to actually look at the moms at my support group closer and be like, wait, are you taking time to rest?
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And I think that's maybe the difference. Like, I would say that my anxiety at that point was probably worse than the depression part. The depression part came later, I think, as a result of months and months and months of anxiety. So the anxiety part, just, I couldn't handle the mess in my house. So my solution was get out of the house so I don't have to deal with it.
Right.
I couldn't handle, like, just sitting still. Like, I couldn't even sit on the couch and watch a television show. Like, feeding my son, he wanted to feed all the time, which now that I'm in the profession I'm in, he didn't need to feed that much. he just, it was like how I thought, I made it up in my head that he was just this kid that needed to eat and eat and eat. And that was the reason why I was anxious, is because all I did was feed this baby, when I didn't look at all the other solutions that I could do to help him feel fuller longer or sleep longer or any of those things. And so there's a lot of things that I think he was a very, very gassy baby, which I didn't realize. I just thought he was crying because he needed to be fed. So his solution to his gas was just fill my tummy back up. And had I just had that support of somebody to say, you need to burp your baby more. Like he's so cranky because he needs to be burped. He's got so much gas in there. Like even something small like that would have been so helpful. But again, we don't notice. And we don't want to say that a mom is doing something wrong. So we won't say like, whoa, he's a cranky baby. Right. Why don't you try doing this? Because it would be offensive, right? But in actual fact, it would be helpful. Sort of, I guess, depending on how you say it.
Right.
And so I remember going to my 6-week doctor's appointment and saying to my doctor that I wasn't feeling very well. And I said, I'm having a really hard time coping. And I would go in there and I'd cry. And I cried and I cried and I cried. And so I asked my doctor, I told her that I wasn't coping well, that I was scared, that I think I even said, the thought of my husband touching me makes me want to throw up. And it was like, I mean, I'm sorry, hun, if you ever listen to this. But that was a big red flag for me, was that I'd always loved intimacy with my husband, whether it be like affectionate, like him cuddling with me, him like holding me. We used to cuddle a lot at night and things like that. And I just, the thought of any of that was just so overwhelming. I just wanted him like never to touch me again. And so I told her that, and she said, oh, it should come back. It should, you know, you'll balance it out. Like you're really tired. And she's like, we can put you on medication. Here's a prescription for, I don't even know what medication it was, but we never really discussed anything about the medication. We didn't discuss how long it takes to work, which is a really important piece. we didn't discuss, oh man, we just didn't, she basically gave me a prescription. And like this doctor is just, I mean, if she ever listens, she's such a lovely person. And I really do truly believe that she means well. I think it's a system failure, though, that we don't have more time to talk to our moms and spend time with them and help them and, you know, really dig deep into how they're feeling. So she gave me this prescription, and I remember coming home and ripping it up and said, there's no way I'm going to go on medication. Like, no way. I'm going to run. And that was my solution. So I'm going to run this horrible feeling away. So I joined a run club, which I think in some ways was really great because I got out of the house. I got to go see other moms that were kind of in the same position as me. They all had kids and they all had little babies. And I've grown some really amazing friendships from this group. So that was really helpful. I think the problem was is that the run group is intended as motivation to get people out, and I didn't have any problem with that. So I took running. I was like, what my psychologist says is metaphorically running. And so I was metaphorically trying to run my feelings away when I thought it was helping. And if I couldn't go for my run that day, I was like, I would step back in depression. And so I had to go for my run every day because otherwise I wasn't moving forward. I was moving backwards. So running was my self-care, quote unquote, but actually was hard, so hard on my body as well. So I ended up telling my husband around like the 4 or 5 month mark that I was feeling really bad and that I was going to go to the doctor and ask for medication at this point because I think I started running and I would be running beside busy roads, and I can remember the intrusive thoughts of thinking like, oh, this would be so much easier if I just run out into traffic. Mm-hmm. And I remember like very, like I'd have to change my route and run on quiet pass because the thoughts that I wanted to run in front of traffic was so strong that it was overwhelming. So I didn't tell my husband that part. He knows it now, but I'd never told my husband that part. I just said that I think that it's time that I go on medication. And he was blown away, had no idea that I was feeling this badly. He said, you know, you look like you're coping so well. And I just cried and cried and cried and said, I'm so tired of feeling so awful. And at that time too, my little guy, like I created such a bad sleep pattern with him. Like I wanted to make him stop crying so bad that I would just go in and feed him. Like as soon as he would like squeak at night, I would go in and feed him. Which now in my job, I know that like he didn't need to be fed every 45 minutes. Like I was breastfeeding and I was a nice big old crutch for him to help go back to sleep. But, and I'll get into that later, but, I was sleeping maybe 25 to 30 minutes at a time. So in the whole night, after the point where I would go and feed him, and then I would have to get myself back to sleep. And that was, I think, a big thing is like moms that don't suffer from anxiety or depression can often just go right back to sleep after they feed their baby. Moms that suffer from anxiety will ruminate about everything. Everything that they're worried about comes out at night. And so I wouldn't sleep. I think I slept for maybe, you know, 20, 30 minutes at a time. And I think in total, I was maybe getting 2 or 3 hours of sleep a night. Like humans cannot function on 2 to 3 hours of sleep a night. No. It's just, it's not humanly possible. And for people to say that we should be because we're moms and, you know, drink more coffee and, you know, we see all these Instagram posts about give me more coffee, I've only had 2 hours of sleep. Like, no, that is not good. And we shouldn't be accepting that as okay. Moms need, if anything, more sleep than anybody else because we are, in order to give our kids like what they need, we need to be able to be like functioning and rested and not driving. Like we shouldn't even really be driving when we've had 2 hours of sleep. Like it's dangerous, right?
No, I'm like getting my caffeine. I've only had 7 hours and 59 minutes of sleep. So
yeah, now I get like less than 8 hours and I'm like, oh my God, I'm so tired. and it's crazy to think that I would go on like my sleep cycles were 20 minutes long when I was back then. So we hired a sleep coach, which was the another amazing decision that I made. I remember just telling my husband, like, I can't do this. I'm hiring somebody to help him sleep. I don't have the capacity to sleep train by myself.
Yeah.
So I asked for support, which in a way, like at the time you wouldn't know that asking a sleep coach is adding to your bucket of support, but it was, and that was an important piece, was getting sleep. So check that off my list. I got him sleeping through the night in 2 nights. He was great. But I still wasn't sleeping. And that was another big red flag, was that he slept great. I would lay in bed and worry about how dirty my house was. I would worry about my family. I worry about every issue I've ever had with my parents or, you know, with anybody else in my life that I've ever had a bad day with. I would worry about that. And it all stemmed back to not feeling perfect. Which now that I know, now I know that is like apparently the number one characteristic of people who experience postpartum depression is perfectionism. And so I fit that bill really well. I needed to feel perfect. I needed to look perfect. I needed to give everybody else in my life the impression that we were just great. So he was sleeping. I was not. And I was also running at this point probably 10 kilometers a day, if not more. I don't know what that is in miles. You Americans with your other system, kilometers. So,
Yeah,
I was running a lot.
Over 3 miles. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well over 3 miles. I think it was like, that's like 4 and a bit, a day. So, And then my eating, I didn't have any appetite because I was anxious. So eating, I like forced myself to eat however many calories a day. And I would like focus on these calories because that was how I, that was part of how I could control what was going on. So I would, the doctors would tell me to eat this many calories. So I would eat that many calories, but like food wasn't enjoyable. I never had that feeling that I wanted to. Like, there was never that, I just really want a big bowl of ice cream. Like, that, all of those things that give people pleasure and, like, eating and social eating and all of that that you get so much joy out of, I didn't get any. So that was another thing is, like, if you can't nourish your mind and then, like, if you're not nourishing your mind with healthy food, then that's another kind of scratch against you on this postpartum depression struggle, right? So I needed healthy food. I needed somebody to basically make me meals so that I would eat them. But all I did was basically just eat the bare minimum to get by because I never had that feeling that I wanted to eat. So then, oh goodness, then what happened? The medication piece, that was another huge piece. So I said that I finally went to my family doctor, who is the most amazing human being I've ever met in my life. Like, just every time I would go in to see her, after I was done sort of with the maternity physicians, she would say, you know, like, how are you doing? I'd bring in my baby for whatever, her cold, and she'd be like, okay, he's fine. How are you doing? Like, I just don't think that you're doing well. And like, she was the one that really knew that I wasn't doing well. And so I would say, no, I'm fine. I'm running. I'm great. And that was about it. And then eventually when I went in for medication, I burst into tears and said, I can't do this anymore. I just can't do this anymore. Just give me something to make this go away. And that was another piece is that when you go on medication, you want this to be better like yesterday. Right. You don't want this to have to take 2 weeks to see if a medication works. Only for it not to work. So if you go, like, some medications work for some people and some medications work for other people. And this medication, like, I think the first two medications actually just made my anxiety 1,000 times worse. And made my intrusive thoughts so much worse. And, you know, if you add up all that time, that was probably 6 weeks of trialing different medication before I actually started on Zoloft, which is great. And so I think Zoloft is the third medication I tried. But by this point I was like, I completely checked out. Like I was like, I had no feeling. Like it was like, I just so badly wanted to cry about something, like anything, just make me sad or make me happy or make me something. But I was so numb because I had lost all hope that this was going to get better. And I was just going through motions every day. Like my kids were healthy. My kids were safe. I never had thoughts that I wanted to hurt them. I only ever had thoughts that I wasn't good enough and that I wanted to hurt myself. And my thoughts surrounding, my intrusive thoughts were very much surrounding the fact that I just wanted this feeling to go away. It was never a thought that I wanted to leave my kids because I recognized very clearly that my kids would suffer without me. Like, mm-hmm. I kept saying, like, you know, any mom is better than no mom. Like, they need a mom. But then I would rationalize, well, my husband is a great guy. He'll get remarried and they'll have a better mom. They'll have a mom that's able to do all these fun things with them. Or they'll have a mom that can be there and isn't so anxious all the time. And then I would think, too, is that, like, okay, I've tried two medications. I'm on the third medication now. When is something going to work? Like, I am going to be that one person that these medications don't work on.
Right.
So finally I got on Zoloft and it took about 2 weeks, I think, to start working, which brings us to 8 or 9 weeks of medication trialing to get me onto something that was helpful. I still hadn't seen a psychiatrist at this point. I'd only been seeing my family doctor.
Were you back at work? Were you back at work?
No, not at this point. I didn't go back to work for a year. Okay. So, yeah, I was still at home. And so then I think, like, a very big day was I think my little guy was probably 8 months old at this point, and I went to my family doctor. She walked in and she looked at me and said, "You're not okay." And I said, "No, I'm not, but I'm here for an ear infection." She was like, she's like, "Do you feel safe?" And I said, "Nope." And that was it. Like, I just, like, I very straight said to her, "No, I don't feel safe. I don't see how this is ever going to get better." And then she said, "Okay, hold on, stay right here." And she went and called, like, God bless her, she's just an angel. She went and called, like, 5 different psychiatrists and basically said, like, "I have this girl here. She will not go to the hospital." That was another thing, is that admission wasn't an option for me. Like, I had this opinion that if I needed to be admitted, then everybody in my life would know how awful I felt and how horrible this was and how I'm a failure and how I can't cope and they'll take my kids away. And, you know, like, it was like so, like, catastrophic thinking was so real. Mm-hmm. And I just thought, you're going to have, like, I would rather be dead than be in a, than go to the hospital. So if that's what you're going to tell me to do, let me go and I'll take care of it myself. And so, she knew that. So she knew that I didn't want to be admitted. So she called all these different psychiatrists to figure out what we could do to help me so that I could get involved with the right team without needing to be admitted. And so thankfully, like, she lit, or her office is about an hour drive away from my house. So by the time I got home, she called a bunch of places. And even just, like, the fact that she cared enough to call all these places was enough hope for me not to hurt myself immediately, like, that day. So I'm like, maybe she is going to come up with a magical solution and they can fix me. Like, I still think they might be able to fix me. And then, so she got me involved with a mobile support team, which I didn't even know existed. They don't, like, again, this is another thing about mental health, is, like, you don't, like, I'm a nurse and I'm in this system and I know these hospitals, right, and I still didn't know that this exists, where that you can call them and say, "I'm in crisis, I need help," and they come to your house and do a mental health assessment in your house. They sent a psychologist and 2 nurses with them, and they came over and were just the loveliest people and sat there and talked to me about how I was feeling, and it was finally like somebody finally understood how I was feeling. So I stayed connected with them for a few more months. Oh, sorry.
You okay?
Good?
Yeah. Yep.
I stayed connected with them for a few more months, and things still kept getting worse and worse. It was a different kind of worse, though, because at this point, I think, because I had been anxious for so long, the depression sort of came in after that. So I was tired. I was so tired, like, just so sleep deprived. My body was running on nothing. Literally running on nothing, because I would still run every day. Like, I ran until the point I got a stress fracture. So I ran until I broke a bone, literally. And I kept running even after that, because that's how important it was to, that's how my thoughts were, is that if I don't run, I'm going backwards.
Right.
So I have to keep running because this is what's going to make me better. And so then, I still kind of, that's when the depression set in, and the lack of sleep, the lack of nutrition, the lack of support, the lack of, like, just not telling anybody how I was feeling. Like, I think there was, like, maybe 3 people in my life besides this team that knew how much I was struggling. It was all just kind of piling up. Like, it was all just a big pile of mess. And so, I just kept getting worse, and this team was so lovely and just kept supporting me and kept pushing for admission. And I remember, like, basically every day they would be like, "So how are you feeling about being admitted?" And I would be like, nope, not doing it. And I knew exactly what I couldn't say to them in order to make sure that I wasn't admitted. Like, I know specifically what legally they need to hear from me in order to send an ambulance to my house and get me taken to the hospital. And so, I mean, I guess knowledge is not always power that way, is that I knew what I needed to keep to myself in order to not get help. So I knew what I couldn't say to not be admitted, which, you know, it's just a really big downfall, I think, of being in the system, like in, of being a nurse and being in the medical system, right? Is like, if I don't want to do something, I know how to get around it. So, they supported me for quite a few months. They were just, they never let me go, which was great. Is when I was like, they would try and push me to do things. And then I would say like, no, I'm not ready. Don't do it. Don't leave me. And they didn't, which was a huge piece of recovering, is that having somebody show me that, like, that I could depend on other people and they would follow through. That was a big piece. So, I went back to work in November 2016. My son was born in, my son was born in October 2015. So it had been about 13 months of being at home before I went back. And it was a really hard transition to go back. And the things that wouldn't normally be anxiety provoking were very anxiety provoking, like finding childcare. We had this horrendous day home that, you know, it was just, the kids were there for 2 days. And then I was like, no way, Jose, you guys, like, this woman was crazy. So I took them out, and then I needed to find somewhere quick because that was my intention of like sending them there. We ended up sending them to like a full-on daycare, but my daughter suffers from pretty strong like separation anxiety. She's had a pretty rough go in her little 4 years of life, medical-wise. So she struggles a lot with feeling overwhelmed and being away from us. So the daycare itself, great daycare, but that environment was really hard for her at that point. And so that was an extra stress because I would drop them off and like my poor little girl would cry like I'm dropping her at the orphanage every day. And it was just awful. Like, and for a mom who's feeling well, you can rationalize to yourself, like, it's good for them, you know, it's good for enrichment, it's good for socialization, it's good for all of us. But all I could see was, what am I doing to my kid? And I felt awful. So that was very stressful. Just the working in general, like I work 12-hour shifts. So going back and working 12 hours just was very hard on my body, because I still at this point wasn't taking care of myself very well. And so it was really hard physically on my body, but also emotionally. Like, I work at the children's hospital, and so seeing sick kids and seeing parents and being emotionally supportive to other people when I wasn't able to even like support myself was very hard. And so I worked not very much. It was enough basically to pay our bills, and that was enough. And so then I think kind of my breaking point, I got through Christmas that year, which was very stressful. Just being around so many people was stressful. The coordination of Christmas, my kids being off routine was very stressful for me. Like, again, this is something that a mom typically can kind of sail through, is like being off for two or three days of your routine is not a big deal. But to somebody who's very set on a routine in order to feel control, like a sense of control, it was a big deal for me. So that really, Christmas was very difficult. And then in the beginning of January last year, so in 2017, January 2017, so not even a year since from where we're at, I made the choice to go to the hospital and be admitted. The reason for that was that I was tired of living with this much anxiety. Like, there was, I just hit that kind of rock bottom where I couldn't fathom living another day with this much anxiety. And there was a little piece of me that really just wanted to live still. Like, there was that tiny, tiny little piece that was like, okay, I have to try everything. Like, I have to try everything. And that part of it is as well was that I had this little tiny person in the back of my brain saying that, you know, something good is going to come from this, because I think that, you're not given struggles like this without something happening afterwards that makes it worth it. Right. And so, I just really needed to, that there was a tiny part of me that still believed that there was something that was good that was going to happen from this. And I knew my kids needed me, and they needed a healthy mom, and they needed a mom that could cope, and they needed a happy mom, because happy moms equal happy kids. Okay. So I decided to go and be admitted. I spent 5 days at the hospital, which essentially was them giving me enough medication so that I could sleep. Like, it was, because at this point I'd probably been going on 2 to 3 hours of sleep for well over a year, and probably more than that, actually, probably like 15 or 16 months, 2 hours of sleep.
Right.
Like, of course your brain isn't going to be working. Right. And so I needed some consolidated rest, and I needed somebody to help me with that. So they gave me a lot of Ativan to help settle my worried brain, and so that I could catch up on this sleep that I needed. And after that, like, I feel like the turnaround point with that one was probably around the 4-day mark, when I was, had gotten some sleep. And I remember thinking, like, okay, let me out. I'm going to turn this around. And like, I think that's probably my perfectionist personality coming out a little bit too, is that, okay, if I'm going to do recovery, I'm going to do it perfect. So, that was like me, that was like, get me out of this place. I'm done. All I need is support. And it was like a light came on in my head that was like, I need more support. That's all I need. I'm on the right drugs. I have, you know, all of this stuff in my toolbox. I've learned all of these tools. I just need people to support me so that I can use these tools. And so that's what I said to the psychiatrist. I was like, let me out. I will come and see you as much as I need to. I'm asking for support right now. And so they were like, that's great. That's what we need. That's all you needed to say. So they connected me with this fantastic outpatient program that, was just, I mean, they're just amazing. Like, I can't even say how much I love this program. They're so lovely, just genuine, lovely people. They connected me with a great team, and that was kind of the key. And it, being able to kind of, like, well, sleep helps. Being able to get sleep. They gave me some meds so that I can sleep at night, which was helpful. And then, I've been working with them. I'm almost finished with them now. I'll be done probably in January. I probably could have been done 3 or 4 months ago, but I just really like to hang on. they've given me every tool I need, and every, they've given me so much confidence that I need to know that anxiety doesn't rule your life, you know? And so I use the analogy of, like, if somebody has been poking, like, if somebody started poking you in the arm every 5 minutes with a pencil, it would be really annoying at first. And then after a year and 3 months of that, you would do anything to make that poking stop, including cut your arm off, because, you know, you would do anything to make that a really annoying feeling stop. And so what I needed to do is figure out how to make that pencil stop myself instead of escape that feeling. So they are great. I owe my life to them. And then around March this year, which was really great timing, I was feeling better quite quickly after this. Like, I think just having the support really turned things around for me. And so they
were around March. When you say support, do you mean like the psychological professional support, or do you mean people helping out more with the kids so you have more time for you?
I think the psychological professional support.
Okay.
People helping with the kids, we did end up like spending more money and getting like a nanny, which was helpful. And she has, like, she came into our lives at the perfect time. She's just amazing, and my kids love her, which is a huge relief. So there was little pieces of those kind of things that all add up to the extra support. But in the end, it was the medical, psychological, all of that support. The program that I was with actually is like a multidisciplinary program. So they have a dietitian, they have psychologists, they have social workers, they have a psychiatrist. They even have like physio and occupational therapy. Like they have like everybody, nurses, everybody. So it was like a whole team was surrounding me with like good vibes to get me better. Mm-hmm. So yeah, there around March of this year was when the Mama Coach approached me, and this is the business that I'm with now. So the Mama Coach approached me and asked me if I'd like to buy a license, and I jumped on it because I realized that it's sort of my life. Like, this was the good that could come from this postpartum depression. Is I've been given sort of this empathy that that you don't get everywhere from everybody else, right? So I can take all of this horrible experience and teach other moms how to ask for help before they get to the point that I was at. Right. So the Mama Coach is a group of registered nurses, I'm part of it, that provide prenatal classes, sleep support, which is a huge thing, lactation support, and just general mom support. So I hired this Mama Coach. She was the one that helped me get my little guy sleeping.
Mm-hmm.
So I really believed in like how she did things, and it's a really great program that the moms get a lot of support with. And so I started doing the Mama Coach in May, and it's just been like my dream job. So basically, I help moms get sleep. I've started my own postpartum support. Well, not really. I don't call it a postpartum depression support because there's moms there that come that don't necessarily have postpartum depression, but it's a free group that I host every Friday. And one of the grocery stores that's like super close to us has this like great room. So I host it in the grocery store.
I love that.
It's awesome. It's awesome. And like, it's a big community thing. So there's lots of people in the community now that come. I usually have about 15 to 16 moms a week come.
Awesome.
It's awesome. Yeah. It's like that has been incredibly therapeutic for me as well, is just being able to teach them things that are one, backed by evidence. They know they're not getting fake news. They're getting, real research-based support. I've used support like 8,000 times in this interview. I'm sorry. They're getting real research-based education, which is different than going somewhere that doesn't have mental health training or any background knowledge about it. So, sorry, did I just totally step on... I hope I didn't totally step on your group.
Oh, you did, but in a good way. Because I was about to say, like, okay, I need you to start sending me stuff. Because, like, it's tough to reach out to the moms in my area. And we still have weeks where, well, we get, like, 7 moms. But then we have weeks where it's just, like, 1 or 2. And mm-hmm. I'm in L.A. County. And there's very, mm-hmm. very few groups. Because I get asked by moms in, like, remote, far from me areas. And they just have nothing. Like... It's like, yeah, I'm sorry, Pasadena is the closest to you that has a group, and it's 40 miles, and I have no, you know, it's a peer group, so you're not stepping on us. I'm inspired. Like, I'm like, okay. I'm about to tell you, like, okay, you need to, like, set up programs, like, share the info so that we can be helping more mamas.
That would be, like, just amazing. So, I started taking the Postpartum Support International Healthcare Certificate, which was, by the way, a really, really great webinar series if you're interested in learning a lot about postpartum. It was interesting because I often, like, I'll listen to the webinar and I'll be like, oh my goodness, like all these signs and symptoms and all these risk factors, like I didn't even have a chance. Like I literally didn't even have a chance. How did I not get help before I needed it? So this postpartum group that I run is just sort of my initiative that I've started, and I kind of rolled with it. I randomly went into a dance studio one day and asked if I could rent space. They said, yep. And I said, okay. And the first probably 3 weeks we had two moms come. And then I just started posting on like Facebook groups, and I started posting on my page, and I started posting on wherever I could, essentially to tell moms, like, there is no judgment in this group. You can come and you can breastfeed or you can bottle feed. You can co-sleep. I won't tell you how to co-sleep, but you can. And you can, you know, there's nothing off the table in this group. And so these moms started coming, and then, you know, a couple times there'd be like a new mom that comes 1 week and she doesn't come back the next week, but then she comes back 3 weeks later.
Right.
And, you know, like, or moms would come and they would look at me and cry. And they would be like, I'm just so tired. And that's when I just take the baby and say, okay, just go sit and have a coffee and I'm going to hold your baby for a few minutes. I actually ended up getting a volunteer baby cuddler to come in so that the moms can get a break and they don't need to feel guilty about somebody else holding their baby for a couple minutes.
Is this a separate group from, so you have the grocery store group?
This is the grocery store group.
Oh, okay.
It started out in a dance studio.
Okay.
Sorry. And then the grocery store was free, so we went to the grocery store. And then, what else? And so then, like, it's just become this really awesome group that I legitimately look forward to every single Friday. It's the highlight of my week. I love coming to see these moms, and the babies come, and, like, they're growing up in front of me, which is so cool. Like, they're, like, reaching all these milestones in front of me, and we talk about it. We talk about all these the changes that's happening. It's just so awesome. Like, it's so awesome. And the best part is that this is my job. Like, I have made this job for myself because of postpartum depression. And I never would have been able to do this without that knowledge of how hard it is and how much I struggled. And without that empathy to be able to give to other moms, I don't think that I would be able to give the same amount that I do now. I've also learned a lot about boundaries. I've learned a lot about self-care for myself and making sure that my self-care does come before my business. And so, yes, I work like insane hours. I probably put in 50-hour weeks to between all of the business side and the seeing mom side and then the marketing sides, all of that. There's just so much. But I don't mind it because I feel like it's helping me. Like I have so much connection to this business now that I don't mind doing all this work. It feels like I'm doing what I'm supposed to be doing. So, I've learned that boundaries are very important in this job, that you can't take on feelings from other people. You can give them resources. You can give people as many resources until you're blue in the face, but at the end of the day, people aren't going to ask for help until they're ready, which is okay. Like, I really think that's okay. You need to be ready to ask for help. And I also think that the best thing that I can possibly do to help moms is tell my story. So tell them how horrible it was. Tell them how I felt. Tell them all these little things, like perfectionist personalities are a huge risk factor for postpartum depression. Any kind of birth trauma at all, whether that's true birth trauma or whether that's even a feeling that you didn't have control in your labor and delivery. It doesn't have to be physical birth trauma to know, like, to have that sort of fallout from it is that if something didn't go the way you were planned, if you didn't receive the medical treatment that you deserved, if you didn't, if you didn't feel like you had control in your birth process, that can lead to postpartum depression. It also leads to PTSD. I think that there's just so much about this that we never talk about. And people might get tired of hearing it from me. They might get tired, you know, other people in my life might get tired of me constantly posting on Facebook how important this is to speak up and to talk to other moms and to give them help and give them support and let them cry. But like, at the end of the day, I don't care if people get tired of hearing about it, because they need to hear about it. You know, like this is important, and we are losing moms because of this. And kids are going without parents because we don't talk about postpartum depression. So I don't care if people don't want to hear it. I'm going to tell them anyway. And the best thing I think that we can do as advocates for it is just tell our stories, be genuine and authentic, and tell them that we asked for help and why it was the best thing we ever did. And how asking for help isn't as scary as you think it's going to be.
Right. The asking for the help is the hardest part of it.
Mm-hmm. Admit it, like accepting that this is how you feel, accepting that that you're not a failure, but you can feel like a failure, that you, there's so much emotions that happen when you ask for help, but at the end of the day, it all comes back to the feeling of guilt and shame, and how if there wasn't that shameful feeling around mental health, it wouldn't be any problem. Like, what kind of mom would say, no, I don't need to go to the hospital for a broken leg. Mm-hmm. No, I'm just going to walk on it and walk on it and walk on it until, you know, it's never going to be healed. But it hurts every day and I can't do anything that I used to do. But let's keep walking on this broken leg. Nobody would do that because there's no shame associated with going to the hospital for a broken leg. But you go to the hospital and say that you need help because you're struggling at being a mom. And there's so much guilt that comes with that. So accepting that guilt and knowing that there's that you have nothing to feel guilty about. Like, this is your brain. Your brain is a huge part of your body. And there's, you know, you just got to fill that bucket up again, you know? So anyways, that's sort of my story.
I love your story. I could hear you talk about it all day.
Talk about it all day. I literally could. I love it. I love talking about this stuff. I still work at the hospital a little bit. So at work we have mental health, like our unit is mental health overflow. So we work with a lot of teens that are experiencing anxiety. And I honestly, like, I could advocate for them all day, every day. And people get so tired of me getting on my mental health high horse. But, like, I just understand so well how hard it is to live with being anxious. And you don't have to live that way. You don't have to. It's not, like, anxiety is something that you can have, but it's not you. Like, you are not the girl with anxiety down the street. You're Sam, and you have anxiety, and you cope with it. So, you know, like, I have days where I know that I'm feeling anxious. I can feel that in my chest, and I can feel how hard it is for me to do things that I normally would find easier. But I know exactly what I need to do now to bring that down. I use guided meditation. I use a lot of breathing exercises. I do a lot of self-care, which is different, and I love to put out there that self-care is different from being selfish, right? You're being able to say, I need a couple of minutes to myself is different than being able, than having, you know, than asking for too much and asking there. I don't think that there is a thing as asking for too much, but at the same time, you're not selfish for asking for self-care. They are two entirely different things. You're not going out and partying to get your needs met. You're spending some time to compress your brain and relax your brain. So yeah, that's kind of the gist of it. But I like with my business, I'm able to help anybody anywhere. So I work out of Calgary, Alberta, but I work through Skype and I work over the phone. I've helped somebody, like a lady from New York City called me a couple weeks ago, and so I'm able to help anywhere. We communicate, like it's 2017, we can communicate anyway. So
how can they find you? Yeah.
They can find me on my website, which is www.themamacoach.ca. Or you can follow me on Facebook. It's just at Sam the Mama Coach. Or on Instagram at Sam the Mama Coach. And yeah, I just think, like, if any mom needs to talk, I'm here. You don't need to, like, I won't charge you to talk to me. I'm not one of those kind of people. I will support any mom at any time. I just want, like, if anybody's gonna, if I'm the only person that you can talk to me. I don't care. Talk to somebody. Just talk. That's the important part. So.
Yeah, we are here. We want to listen. We want to hear it.
Exactly.
And then you said something, I forget if you said this at the beginning of the podcast or before we started recording, but how this is therapeutic work for you.
This is incredibly therapeutic work for me. And I recognize that as like part of my recovery was being able to recognize that this happened for a reason. So whether you're spiritual or not, whether, you know, whatever faith you belong to, whatever you believe, I just think that there's truth to knowing that you can overcome struggles because of other ways. And so I think that this has just been so therapeutic because I've seen so much benefit from it. And I've seen moms that get help sooner than I did. And I've seen how just a empathetic ear makes the world a difference. And so, yeah, it's super helpful for me to be able to give this back to my community. And I see the change happening, which is also helpful. It's like I legitimately can see moms talking about this, and I can see how me being honest and open and authentic on the internet, which is hard to do, is helping other moms and helping them understand that this isn't their fault. They haven't done anything wrong, and they're great moms, and that's, you know, I think anybody who asks for any help at any time should be considered a superhero because they're great moms who want to be better moms. And that's the important part, right? So yeah, it's just been like the best last 6 months ever. I'm so happy with how things are going. Almost feels too good to be true sometimes. Like sometimes I wake up and I'm like, do I really have this job? Oh yeah, I do. It's awesome.
I think on that note, I'll say thanks for coming on the show today.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
So that is it for this week. Thank you, Sam, so much for sharing your story with us. And this was my first interview in, gosh, it must be like 6 months or so. And I needed that break, but I really needed Sam to be the first interview back because it was just like the whole time that she's doing the interview, like 90% of me was listening like really closely and intensely taking notes and just like really like absorbed by her story. But then another 10% of me just kept like observing and thinking like, oh my gosh, I missed this. This is what I'm supposed to be doing. I'm so glad I'm doing this interview and I can't wait to do more interviews in 2018. So if you're a longtime listener or a new time listener and you would like to share your story on a future episode, I've started scheduling interviews for 2018. Don't worry, you can wait until January to contact me. This is not going away anytime in the foreseeable future. You can email Courtney at ppdadventures.com and we will work something out. I have a couple of weekdays where I have the babysitter that I can do interviews, but I also can do weekends. So I know that as new mamas, we often have, or even older mamas, we have difficult schedules. So I can work with you to make something, you know, flexible or not flexible. I'm rambling now. And for those of you who've been thinking about it and you're sitting there and you're like, ah, this just sounds like what if I have to schedule? What if I have to cancel? I get it. I've had moms who have been on the show where we had to cancel and reschedule multiple times. I've had moms who freaked out, or, you know, just for not even necessarily freak out, just decided this isn't right for me, and the interview didn't happen. And that's okay. Like, we all have different journeys, and maybe your journey is contacting me and scheduling an interview and then canceling, and that's it. Okay, that's fine. Like, I have nothing but love for all of you listening and sending out good vibrations to all of you. And if never sharing your story on this show is your journey, awesome. But if you want this, but if you feel like sharing your story on this show is part of your journey, I'd love to make it happen. So again, Courtney@ppdadventures.com. I already have a few interviews scheduled to do in January. Yay. So I'm very excited that more interviews will be coming to you in the new year. I don't know that I'll be back before the new year. Kind of depends on how the holidays go. We're like 9 days away from Christmas as I sit in my cold guest room and record this. So I guess I got to finish wrapping up things for the holidays, literally and figuratively, and just want to enjoy this time with my children and lots of snuggles. But I also miss you guys when I don't do this. So maybe I'll flutter in for another quick little episode. We'll see. And if not, just think of me at the Rose Parade, because the Rose Parade passes right by my house, like a block from my house in Pasadena. So I will be at the route, not anywhere where they're filming. So you will not see me on TV and you won't catch my voice at all. But every time I watch the Rose Parade, ever since I've had postpartum depression, I imagine how incredible would it be to someday have a float in the Rose Parade dedicated to maternal mental health. And you could have like 100 moms on the float, and instead of, like, you know, beauty pageant winners, they would be moms who survived postpartum depression or anxiety or OCD or psychosis. Moms like Sam, who are, you know, ready to just share their story with the world in the hopes of helping other moms. I always just sit there, like, mostly watching the parade, but also a little part of me fantasizing about what the float would be like and how beautiful and amazing that would be. So yeah, think about that on New Year's Day. Think about, like, send out the idea into the world that we need the mamas with postpartum depression Rose Parade float. In other news, for those of you who've been listening for a while or not so long, and you may have noticed that episodes are disappearing from the podcast feed. We're over 50 episodes now, and I am, like, way past my storage limit with my podcast host. You know, I should do an episode one day about how podcasts work, because I bet some of you are thinking you need to do a podcast either about maternal health or something else like that you find interesting. I think podcasts are just so much fun to have out there. So I would like to do an episode to just tell you how it works. But you basically end up having, like, some sort of provider, quote unquote, I don't know, who, like, hosts the memory for your episodes, and you upload the episodes, but you pay for how many episodes you have. So, you know, I started with, like, the most simple basic plan, and once I'd done, like, more than 10, I was like, oh, I love doing this. I upgraded, and I've kept upgrading, and I'm at the point where I'm like, I can't upgrade anymore, because it's like, you are a professional podcaster and it's $10,000 a month. And it's not $10,000 a month, but it's a number where you're like, maybe that's a little more for something that I do for free. So I've decided, I'm like, okay, I'm capped. I can keep about 30, 40 episodes on the feed, and I'm having to pull off and put into draft mode the other episodes. And I'm working on this, and I've created an account on Patreon, and I'm uploading old episodes there. And I'll let you know in future episodes, or you can check the website, or you can just look me up on Patreon. I'm sure you can find me if you search for postpartum depression. And for a fee of $2 a month, you'll be able to access all the back episodes. So if you're binging and you're like, wait, I still need more episodes, you could just sign up for 1 month, and, you know, for $2, you'll get all the episodes. I was looking at YouTube, but I don't know, I'm, like, technologically dumb, and I just could not figure out how to make that work. And I also have ideas for YouTube videos I would like to eventually do, maybe in 2018. So I didn't want to, like, dilute my YouTube presence with a bunch of podcasts. I just get really annoyed when I go to watch something on YouTube and it turns out it's a bunch of audio, and then, like, there's, like, a couple of words, like, spinning or bouncing around the screen. I'm like, no, it's a video. I want a video. So I just feel kind of like, it just doesn't feel right for me. Like, I know some people put their podcasts out there and they put them on YouTube. That's fine. But it just didn't feel right for me. And then I had so much difficulty trying to get the first episode uploaded to YouTube. I was like, okay, this is the universe's way of saying my podcasts don't belong on YouTube. So I did a little more searching, and I decided Patreon was great because maybe you've been listening to the show and you're like, I would like to throw a couple bucks at Courtney just to make sure the show keeps happening. And my real dream is if I can raise enough funds, I would like to start getting transcripts made for episodes. I did try to do a transcript myself of like one of my last interviews from 6 months ago. And I thought, okay, so it's like a 45-minute interview. So what, this will take like an hour? And it's like 6 hours later, it's like, holy shit, I cannot make a transcript myself. So I was looking into it, and it costs like $1 a minute to do a transcript. So you figure 45 to 60 bucks per interview. So as I make money, I think like your feet off Patreon, as I slowly hit like the $60 mark, you know, again and again, I'm just going to go to like the most recent episode that needs a transcript and get someone to make it. Because if the transcript's out there, there's a lot of moms who would really benefit from these stories, but who for whatever reason don't want to listen to a podcast, and the story will just be written and you can read these, you know, you can read an interview in like 7 minutes as opposed to like sitting and listening. So, okay, I'm rambling now. That's what's happening. That's why episodes are disappearing from the feed. I'm trying to make sure that the episodes where it's just me talking about a part of my story, I'm making those disappear first, and I'm keeping the interviews available as long as possible. And I probably will try to do a rotation where things that, like, you know, bring back, like, the first, like, bring back episodes 10 through 20 for a while, and then for a few months bring back episodes 20 through 30. Like, I'm figuring this out as we go. You know, it's life, it's motherhood, it's living. You figure it out as you go. You can't plot everything to the end of time. And I have been talking far long enough, and my children are still watching creepy YouTube videos. And I have, like, when I left the room, there was a dancing red baby. Like, the baby had been dipped in, like, a red liquid, and it was fully this red demonic cartoon baby. So I'm hoping something has changed since then. Maybe, like, I miss Moana. We had this phase where we were watching Moana, like, once a day. Where's Moana? Bring back Moana! Not Play-Doh! I want Moana! Okay, on that note, I wish you all a very Merry Christmas. Sam, thank you so much for sharing your story and bringing the joy of interviewing back to me, which is not to say the old interviews weren't joyful. It's just, my goodness, oh gosh, can you hear children screaming in the background? It's just, like, you know, you sometimes have to cycle through various things, and I think my children are now screaming and throwing fits, so that's my sign to hit the sign-off button. I love you all. Postpartum depression is a very lonely and isolating illness. You are not alone. You did nothing wrong to bring this on yourself, and with proper support like Sam got, you can and will make a full recovery. I love you, and have a very happy holiday.